Real people. Real opinions. Real talk radio. The multi-award-winning Niall Boylan Show. Classic hits.
I want you to cast your mind back. I remember I was working here actually on the day. As far as I remember, it was a Monday on July the 29th, 2013. And I'm sure most people remember the name Sanjeev Chadha. He murdered his two sons, Owen, who was 10 years of age at the time, and 5-year-old Rory, in cold blood. He was given two life sentences after he pleaded guilty. And now it seems that he wants to make an application for parole. And joining me on the line is his former wife, Kathleen Chadha. Good afternoon to you, Kathleen.
Hi, good evening.
And Kathleen, I don't want to be disrespectful to you, and I kind of struggled with whether I should use the word former wife or what the right term is.
Okay.
So
I often say, I can't deny him. I can't deny that I was married to him. I don't want to be honest.
Yeah.
I suppose I look at it and go, if I hadn't met him and hadn't married him, I wouldn't have had
two beautiful children. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, just I suppose in context for that, I have one family photograph still hanging at home because we were a happy family at one point.
I wanted, just before I get to the parole, because just to remind people and I suppose jog people's memories, because, you know, they always say out of sight, out of mind. And for you, every day is that living nightmare because, of course, you don't have your two children anymore. But for many people, I suppose life goes on. We saw it in a headline in the paper. We saw it on RT News. We saw you at the courts in RT News, of course, the day he pleaded guilty and was given two life sentences. But then for everybody else, their life goes on. We just get a snapshot of your life. As tragic as that story was, and that story has been replicated around the country many times, as I'm sure you've followed and watched other stories very similar to it around the country. But for everybody else, I suppose, you know, their life goes on. And just to remind people again, of what actually happened on that day. I mean, you mentioned that you were a happy family. Was there ever anything that gave you an indication that, you know, he would be the type of person that could commit such a horrible, depraved act?
No, absolutely none. And in fact, I was reminded not so long ago by one of the detectives or the guards in locally. I was worried about him that particular day, believe it or not. And I kept saying, he's got the boys with him. He'll be okay. He had been found out having embezzled about €60,000 from our local community centre 10 days before. He had a gambling habit. I suppose he was trading. Stocks and shares, but gambling. That was hidden in the open. That's the only way I can describe that.
And were you aware of how serious his habit was?
No. No,
okay, you just knew he had a problem.
He knew. No, I didn't even. It was he dabbled. It was he was Sanders on the computer. He, you know, it didn't affect our own finances. I worked. He was a stay-at-home dad. I would have considered at the time we were lucky enough that we were in a position that we could afford to live on one salary, and we made that decision because it was the right decision for us as a family and for Owen and Rory. I had a good job. That I liked, and so we had made that decision when Owen was born, or soon after, I suppose, Owen was born, really. So it was just that was his hobby, his pastime, was how
it was. And what had happened that when you say we had just found out, did the guards call to the door, or was there an investigation into it?
I think it had been found out through,
locally.
I don't actually know a huge amount of the details, but it had been found out locally within the committee. And
did he share that with you then, that information with you?
Not by himself.
Okay.
It came via a third party at the time. And I'd say that would have been about 10 days beforehand. So after I had found out, I did worry about him and his state of mind initially.
Yeah.
For the first couple of days. But actually after about 4 or 5 days, That worry had gone, because actually a week, because you're correct, it was a Monday that it happened. And for the week previous to that, he was in I would have said, a better headspace. And I actually put it down to the fact that he was relieved. It was all out in the open now and we were going to deal with it. And I hadn't kicked him out. Mm. I hadn't.
You were going to not so much support him, but help him through this, or help him get through. As a family, you were going to get through this.
We would get through this. It wasn't going to be easy.
Yeah.
No, it was quite tense between us.
I can imagine, yeah.
The bus, but at the same time, you know...
Did you still, and Kathleen, and please don't take this as some sort of insulting question, but did you still love him at the time?
Oh, yeah. That didn't change. That didn't... Yeah. Suddenly, you don't turn off a switch.
Yeah.
And that, I think, in a way, was one of the hardest parts for me.
To know that somebody you love could do something like that to your flesh and blood. And that Monday, I mean, where were you, I mean, I suppose, when this happened? Or what time of the day was it? Remind us again. It was early in the day, anyway.
So what happened was that the previous night, he had taken the boys to go bowling. Supposedly, I was going off for a walk with a friend. He was going bowling, and he didn't come back home that night. I went looking for him, and he wasn't where he had said he was going to be in Carlow. I got back home and called the guards straight away. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, they were incredible. They took it seriously. You know, I mean, my only experience really had been watching all of the, you know, the document or the you know, your CSIs and your Law and Orders or whatever. But there was no, I mean, they took it seriously, literally from the first moment that I spoke and started the process. So we'd gone through all that night. I had thought maybe he's in... gone to the UK. That was something that I thought maybe he had driven because we had just come back from the UK about 3-4 weeks previously. Thought maybe he's gone to the UK, even though the passports were there. I suppose I was holding on to that. His mum was living.
So loads of things are going through your mind. You're probably looking around to see if the boys' clothes were there. Did he take clothes with him?
Did he take them? What did he take? He'd left his phone behind, but again, it was a new phone, smartphone. Kind of smartphones were really only even, it's only 7 years ago, but they were only really coming out then. And so the smartphone didn't fit in his pocket as easily, so maybe he'd just forgotten it. You put all of these things in together. But honestly, until the moment that it was confirmed, I kept going, it'll be okay. He's got the boys with him. They'll be okay. And I thought, you know, okay, This changes things now. You know, this is when they come back, he's going to have to leave. But how do I do that for Owen and Rory? I have to be careful for them, you know, et cetera, et cetera. He's obviously had, you know, whatever in his mind. He's had a breakdown. He's had whatever. And
did the guards call? Obviously, the guards called to the door, which is that visit that nobody ever wants to see. That visit.
No.
And when you saw, I'm assuming when you opened the door and the guards were there, what was the first thing that came into your mind? Because obviously you knew there was something wrong.
Oh no, it wasn't that simple. It was he himself that gave me the news. So I'm on the phone. I was actually being interviewed by one of the guards at the time, one of the detectives. Phone call came through on my phone, a number I didn't recognise, but that wasn't unusual that night or that day. This was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the Monday, and it was Sandra on the other end of the phone, of the line. And basically he said, I'm looking at the guard, I'm thinking, okay, keep him on the line. Where is he? Where was he? Where were the boys? And he just said, there's been an accident. And I went, are the boys okay? And he said, no, they're dead in the back.
Oh my.
What
was the tone? I mean, I'm sorry to be inquisitive, but what was the tone? He was calm.
Calm. That's all. And I dropped the phone. I know the detective picked it up at that stage, and God love him. I came. There was a lot of people in the house at the time, all my family and friends, neighbours, etc. And I basically, I kind of collapsed, if you like.
I can only imagine.
And I remember staring at that poor detective who was the one basically was holding everything, because he was again in touch with his colleagues that were actually at the scene of the crash, and he had to get confirmation from them that Owen and Rory were dead. And I'm sitting there, and he knew I was sitting there waiting for him to come back and tell me, no, they're okay. Because I thought, well, if Sanjay's okay and he was driving, how can they be
dead? Yes, yeah.
You know, they're probably stunned or they're unconscious or whatever. But in my mind, I was getting myself ready to go to wherever they were. I didn't even know where they were at that point. So
it's quite cold, isn't it? The very fact that he could be so calm telling you something like that after, of course, we all know now, after the fact that he did it. I mean, even if a father, if it had been an accident and two children were killed, how could a father even make that phone call? You know, and in any kind of, look, you'd be hysterical. You know what I mean? It's quite bizarre and quite a strange situation. So,
but he'd had a number of hours to actually drive around, and that's the thing. So the boys had been killed about 5 in the morning, and this is now 2:33 in the afternoon. So he'd had quite a lot of time to drive around. He'd stopped off to get petrol and coffee. Mm-hmm. So whatever way his mind was working that time, and that's part of the, I suppose, again, part of the difficulty is that isn't the person that I knew him to be.
And the way he did it too, and I'm not going to go through the injuries, of course, the boys had, because that's certainly not something I want to do tonight, but certainly that we know that obviously he took Owen's life first.
Yeah.
And Rory secondly. So what goes through your head is that Rory would have seen this and lived through that, I suppose, of watching his brother being killed.
So his last moments were that. It all happened within the car. It was all very... It had to be. Again, the only person that knows is Ange himself.
But it takes a certain type of hatred. I'm assuming he didn't hate his children.
That's the conundrum, and that's, you know, I'm constantly contradicting, I feel, things when I say that, because he did love Owen and Rory. I actually don't doubt that he loved them, but what kind of love does what he did? So it's a really difficult one that I've over 7 years I've simply had to.
But you do believe he wants to kill the whole family, including you.
Yeah, he did.
He was afraid to take you on because you might fight back, obviously.
Yeah.
Is that the type of person he would have been? Would he normally be, say, confrontational anyway?
No. He was the least confrontational person that I would have known in many ways. Talking to his friends and, you know, even over the years, forget, you know, what actually happened. But when I first got to know him and I first knew him, he was incredibly placid, very even-tempered. We would have had differences of opinions, but we never had major rows. You look at it now and you think differently, and you look back and you think, okay, was that a sign actually in and of itself? But he wasn't a confrontational guy. He wasn't, as far as being with the boys, he would have disciplined the boys, but there was no physical discipline. There was no... at all, and you know, you would have looked on from the outside and seen a
doting father. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. You know,
I mean, and he had written a number of notes as well to you, because obviously this is premeditated. Yeah. So he'd written a number of notes to you, basically asked you to bury him with them, because the pain of separation, he said, would be was going to be too bad for them. Mm. I mean, the fact that we knew that he planned this, it wasn't just something, when people, I suppose, you know, go over the edge or they suffer from depression or clinical depression or whatever it is, it's something that people do at the spur of the moment. There's been many cases of that around the country. But for somebody to actually set out to plan to do something, I think in everybody's mind makes it even worse, because he was obviously copus mentis and knew exactly what he was doing.
He knew exactly what he was doing. He knew the impact. It's not that he had to know. He knew the impact that this is going to have on me. He invited me in one of the letters to join them, you know, and almost as though if I didn't, that was, you know, that I wasn't honouring the boys' memories. The letter that he wrote to Owen and Rory, they said something along the lines of, you know, Mummy is getting rid of me. And again, part of that, because I wasn't. That's the part that kind of angers me. There's lots that anger me. So, but it's one of the aspects where I go, but no. So what he was doing constantly was justifying to himself what he was doing, and what he was about to do, or what he had done.
I mean, you obviously had. He pleaded guilty, thankfully, so there wasn't a long trial. But in saying that, there was a time you obviously had to wait until that trial came up where he pleaded guilty to murdering both your children. I don't know how... It's bad enough for somebody to lose a child. It's bad enough for somebody to lose two children. But to lose two children from your own husband, at the hands of your own husband, and the confusion that lies, you know, within that, that, how do you get through something like that? And people are... want to know how you can, because we smaller things happen to most of us in our lives and we find it difficult to get through. How can you get through something like that?
I could be slightly flippant and say a really good psychologist, but actually it helped. I look at it for myself, and it's funny, it's something that your researcher had said, you know, and an awful lot of people say, I don't think I could do it, Kathleen. I do believe now that everybody has the capability within themselves. Now, and I'm not going to get sort of too deep and meaningful in that, but actually I do believe we all have it. It's just that thankfully very few of us ever have to pull on that or ever have to find that deep within us.
Is it a case of trying to put it at the back of your mind and trying to focus on other things throughout the day as your day goes on and live your life like that?
I am incredibly lucky with the family and friends and support that I have. Mm-hmm. I come from a very grounded background that helps. And I suppose I look at it and time. I mean, I would have spent the first 6 months on my couch, and that's part of it. You see me, you hear me on my good days. You don't see, and the people don't see the days where I am on the couch watching silly television. I mean, I could have told you at that time exactly what was on. Was it the Ellen Show and
you know, anything just to take your mind off it?
Anything to take your mind off it, and that's what it was. It had to be the TV because it had to be visual. Mm. So that was the first, I'd say, 4 to 6 months. I would have gone out. I'd have gone to visit. You know, I'd gone over to my parents' house and that. But it was important for me to stay in my own home in those days. But I genuinely did start seeing a psychologist very early on, and I was very lucky.
Did you want to be with people at that time, Kathleen? Because I know that I remember when my own brother died, and my mother did, because he drowned, he went missing and he drowned. But I remember my mother saying at the time, she didn't really want people coming around saying, listen, we're sorry, Lily, we're sorry this happened. And because she just didn't want to be constantly reminded. She wants to try and forget. I know you can't forget about it, but to try and forget about it.
You need time to just allow your mind to recover ever so slightly in the short term, and that's what it is. So it's little moments that take you out of that absolute horror that your mind is in. But I didn't want to see people, and yet I needed to be around people. Give you an example, you know, I remember sitting with my sister one evening, she was having a packet of potato or crisps, and I felt every single crunch that she made. It's like it's a physical thing for to have somebody sitting beside you, and there are times where the voices, tea, somebody drinking, all of those things just get you. But what I would have done at that stage was literally just taken myself out of it, either gone to the loo, up to my bedroom, whatever, for a few moments. And if I was able to then bring myself back, I'd come back down. Otherwise, I was up. And
well, did you find yourself watching, say, videos or looking at pictures of them constantly all the time?
The boys, not a huge amount. I had one particular photograph that I just hope have everywhere with me. I didn't look at loads and loads. I couldn't, to be honest with
you. And that's why I was asking you. He would have been in if you have home videos and stuff.
A lot of them. And as a mum, what I found as I did go looking was that most of the photographs were of him with the boys. There wasn't so many. I tended to be behind the camera instead of in front.
I mean, and he went from being my husband to being the murderer of my children. So
I probably spent the first year dealing with the my husband bit and that betrayal before I even started to do any work on the grief and loss of Owen and Rory, in a way, because it was easier. It was actually easier to deal with the trauma of him and what he had done and separate the two. And that's what I ended up doing in my head. Separating the two.
Because we forget that when we think of this story, we forget about the fact that you're not just grieving over the loss of your two children, which is bad enough in itself, you're also grieving over the loss of a husband. Now, not when I say a husband, it's a man you were married to and who you thought loved you and loved your children.
And I couldn't grieve. A lot of people would have said, look, you know, because I would be very adamant, I wish he had gone himself that night. It would have been easier for me in the long run. And a lot of people would say, well, no, he needed to have his punishment. But actually, him having his punishment prolongs mine.
In relation to his punishment, so yes. Obviously it was all brought back again for you a year later when he was in court, and thankfully he pleaded guilty to the two murders and got two life sentences. Obviously you saw him in court.
Yeah.
You didn't get an opportunity to talk to him, obviously, apart from give a victim impact statement, which I'm sure you probably did at the time.
Yeah.
But if he was standing, have you ever thought about what you would say if he stood in front of you, or what the first question you'd ask him? Have you ever thought about that, or what you would like to say to him? Or is there something that's... why is the obvious one, but I mean...
How did you have it inside you to do it? Because the why bit of it nearly... I'm almost gone beyond whys at this stage. It's how. You claim to love them. You claim to love me. How could you actually physically do what you did? Where did that come from? And to be honest, my biggest fear is that he would actually try to tell me and somehow try to justify it. And I say that's a fear because actually the thought of him, of me listening to him trying to justify it is
quite stomach turning, really, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
There's nothing, I mean, if I was in your position, there was nothing he could say to me obviously not to justify. There's no justification in any of this. But there's nothing he could say to make it any easier.
No.
Absolutely nothing.
Nothing.
So there is no way of answering that question.
No. Which is why I would say it would have been easier if he had killed himself that day as well.
Was he remorseful in court?
I believe he was as remorseful as he is capable of, maybe. That particular day when I saw him, that wasn't...
I mean, was he upset in the courtroom when he saw you?
Yeah, he was crying. I think he probably cried throughout the whole afternoon. Mm-hmm. He cried when I gave my victim impact statement. I had to walk past him to go up to sit in front of the judge. As I walked back, he did say, "I'm sorry." I'm so sorry, I think were his words. And it actually doesn't matter. I don't have to take it or not take it or anything because it doesn't actually make a difference. But I suppose if I take myself back to the family that we were, mm-hmm. And the father and the husband that he was, you take something from that. I'm not actually sure what it is that you take.
I get exactly what you mean because I'm a family man and I value, sadly I'm going through a divorce at the moment, separation, but what I miss most about everything that I had before was my family, was just the unit. And if you understand me, so it's the family that I miss, and he took your family away from you, essentially, is what you're saying, because that to you was really important.
And even if, you know, I'm not comparing it to yours, but
no.
You still have an ex-partner, an ex-wife, mm-hmm. and you have shared memories of your children. Mm-hmm. So those shared memories with Sanj, I have no one to share them with now. Even if you separate, even if it's an acrimonious separation, I think with a couple, there's still a point in time where you know you have grandchildren come along, and you can. You still have that little bit of a connection that tells you, you know, what they were like, your grandchildren are like, your children when they were the same age, that sort of thing. You have weddings, first communions, confirmations, things like that. Whereas that's completely
that's
gone.
He took all those opportunities away from you.
Yeah. And all of those, you know, I fight or fought to keep the good memories because that was, you know, it was vital to me.
Well, the reason we're talking to you tonight is because he is now going to make an application for parole. I mean, I know it's only literally, at this stage now, I mean, 2014 you went to jail, it's not even 6 years yet. And he wants to make an application for parole. How long, when we talk about two life sentences, obviously they will run, not consecutively, but what's the other word again?
Concurrently,
that's it, of course. And they run concurrently. What was the recommended sentence by the judge? Can you remember at the time?
It was two life sentences.
Okay,
but so Judge Carney kept it very, very simple.
Who's passed away, sadly, since then, I think.
Two run concurrently. Yeah. That was it.
Okay, and was there any? Were you given any expectation of how long those life sentences would be?
No, because there isn't one.
Well, there isn't, no.
Unfortunately,
sometimes a judge will recommend a certain amount of time before parole can be given.
But with life sentences, they actually, it our constitution doesn't allow for it.
So this is why we're talking to tonight, because I know they passed a bill in 2019. Well, when I say they passed a bill was run through the Dáil in 2019, but it was never actually passed. And this obviously was to represent families of murder victims who are now calling on the new Justice Minister, Helen McEntee, to urgently commence a parole act, which was passed in Irish law last July. Now, the new bill requiring killers to serve at least 12 years before applying for early release. And even 12 years is not a lot for a life sentence, to be honest with you.
It's not.
No.
But it's a start, you see. That's how I would view it. It's
a start. So you've written a letter. And the reason you wrote it, or you want to make this letter public, of course, was because he can write letters, of course, the parole board. You don't even get to see those, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you wrote this letter. He'll get to see your letters. So you want to make sure everybody else hears your letter. Do you have the letter there with you?
I do. And as we're talking, my laptop has just died.
Okay. Will you just boot it up there again if you want?
That's what I'm
as you're talking to me. Okay, but that's always, things like that always happen. Don't worry about it.
I know, live radio, etc.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to have to see now if I actually have, actually bear with me. I might be
okay,
able to get
take your time, take your time.
One second.
Okay, just if you have joined us, we're talking to Kathleen Chadha, who is the former wife.
Is it appropriate to say talk amongst yourselves?
No, it's okay. Of Sanjeev Chadha.
I'm joking. I know.
And you know what, Kathleen, it's lovely to hear you. And I'm not saying in such a good mood, and I don't mean that in some sort of horrible, callous way. But it's lovely to hear that you've come through this, because I did think about you many times, because we discussed it on the show when it happened at the time, as we did many other, you know, serious stories that had come out in the papers at the time. And I remember thinking about it. We talked about you in the office here in your absence. I'm sure your ears were burning all over the country, because everybody was talking about you and talking about what you were going through. So it's lovely to hear you now, and the fact that you've got through this, because many people will think you're a wonderfully brave woman for coming through something like this.
Thank you. I suppose, and it's funny, if you knew me and my family, we have a certain dark humour within the family at times, but it actually is what helps you through. It does get you through these times. Mm. And it doesn't, it's not a disrespect to Owen and Rory, because they would have been a part of it when, you know. And one of the things that I found really, really important was actually people knowing that I'm normal, if you like, that I am, and I'm still me. I'm still the Kathleen that I was before the boys died or were killed. So that is important. It is important to know that and to recognize that. And, you know, that I often say with some, I suppose with friends, you know, when it comes to suicide, they talk about it's okay not to be okay.
Yeah.
I often say it's okay to be okay in circumstances as well, because sometimes there's an expectation that
you should be sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That we should be sad all the time, or people don't expect to see me laughing or smiling, or, you know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's a very old, there was a very old Irish thing years ago that, you know, when a woman's husband died, particularly, you know, that she should wear black for a year. And we expected, you know, if somebody's seen her out for a drink a year and a half later with some friend, they'd be going, how can she do that?
How can she do that?
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's a very old way of thinking, isn't it, that we shouldn't be allowed to get over it. When I say get over it, get through it.
To get through it. And, you know, and as I say, you know, what you see and what you hear, not just you, but people see and hear is the me that's, you know, that on the good days. Now I have it.
Okay, good. Because I think about it as, if you didn't have it, I have it here in front of me. I was going to read it for you. But I prefer you to read it, because this is the letter, of course, you wrote to the Irish Prison Service and the Parole Board. Obviously, your feelings over him making an application for parole. But go ahead.
And I kept it quite short, as it happens, because I debated this. This was written and rewritten a number of occasions, because it doesn't, it should be obvious. But I'll read it and we'll come back to it then. To whom it may concern. That I actually have to write this letter is an insult to the memory of my sons Owen and Rory Chadha. Owen and Rory were and are the most precious and loved of boys. They were loving,
caring, kind children who loved their lives, their families, and each other unconditionally. That love was betrayed in the most brutal way on the 29th of July 2013 by their own father, someone they loved and trusted totally. That he was capable of doing to them, of what he was capable of doing to them, is beyond my comprehension and should be beyond the comprehension of any human being, in my opinion. That he, Sanj, feels entitled after just 7 years to apply for parole, having carried out such a calculated, gruesome act on two innocent and defenseless children for his own gratification, shows how inhuman he actually is. The reasons that he should not be granted parole or any other concessions, having served just 7 years of two life sentences, should be obvious to anyone who looks at what he has done. That he chooses to apply in the first place shows the weak and pathetic man he is, with no insight into the ongoing impact of his actions. That impact reaches beyond just myself. It impacts my family, extended family, friends, community, and beyond. How does someone like him be rehabilitated into society? You cannot. Therefore, he will always be a threat to me, to my family, and to society in general. Kind regards.
That's wonderfully written, I have to say, and I think everybody listening would be saying exactly the same thing in the situation you were in. And I suppose you talk about, you know, how he could be reintegrated into society. I mean, that was one of your fears as well, that you could imagine him visiting the graves of Owen and Rory as well, and something that you couldn't even comprehend.
And that's it, because he will be the, presumably, model prisoner. He will engage. He's, you know, he was quite a, he was, I suppose he was quite a, an easygoing person. And that has probably come back. I think he has, as I understand it, settled or adapted well to prison life, I think was the quote. You know, so when he, and that's the thing, when it comes to the parole board, you know, these are strangers that are going to assess what he writes, all the reports that will come from the various agencies involved, and we'll be interviewing him. So they see a tiny little capsule of the person that he is now, not the person that carried out the brutal murder of his two sons. And so I think, for me anyway, it's important that the parole board get that picture as well, and that part of the picture, that they can see the, I suppose, the person that that he was, and that led him to do what he did. Because if he could conceal that side of himself from me for all the years that we were together, and from many other people, including his own family, then it will be very easy for him to conceal it to a parole board.
I mean, I don't believe, I've always been of the opinion that people don't become evil.
No.
I always believe that people are evil, but as you rightly said, conceal it quite well.
Yeah.
For whatever circumstances throughout their life, they meet the right person, whatever it is, and they can conceal that, I don't know, narcissism, schizophrenia, whatever it is they happen to have at the time. But I think they can conceal it. But I think at some point it always reveals itself throughout life. But I think I always am of the belief that people are born like that, are born with that ability to be like that.
And you know, that's the thing. I it didn't suddenly appear on the 28th, we'll say, of July 2013 as he was driving away from the house. No. You know, as I said, the week before, you know, that it happened, when I thought he was kind of, you know, he was in better form and, you know, seemed a bit more, you know, I look back on it now and I see it was because he had made the decision. He knew what he was planning to do and he knew he wasn't ever going to have to face up to what he had done. And then he had the, I mean, I call it the arrogance. That word doesn't even do justice to it, but he had the arrogance to feel that he was entitled to take Owen and Rory's life because they couldn't possibly survive without him. You know, he wanted to be around for them and to teach them, etc. Well, you know,
It's the phone call that breaks my heart. I mean, the fact that he would ring you calmly and tell you what had happened.
What had happened? I mean, he didn't. I've said that a number of times. He didn't even grant me the dignity of having somebody break. I mean, how do you break that news? It really doesn't matter.
They're the actions
how,
of a sociopath. But, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it didn't. You know, it shouldn't have been him.
And by the way, just finally, I mean, he will get released at some point, and I'm sure you're well aware of that, at some point within the next 20 years anyway.
Yeah, I'll keep fighting, but yeah.
I know. Do you fear for your own safety? You mentioned before that maybe, you know, you do fear. Do you fear for your own safety if he ever gets out?
It is always there if he's out. I have to have some faith in whatever system will be about in, you know, sort of 15 to 20 years' time.
Mm.
That I won't be in danger, but it is there. I'm conscious of it every time I, you know, do an interview or it's in the papers or something like that. I'm very vocal about it. So, you know, does that add a potential threat? Probably not at this stage. But
no, I don't think so.
It is there. You know, and you know, you can use the words very, very blasé-like to say, oh, God, I wanted to kill him, or he wanted to, you know, my husband could have killed me. Well, actually, he meant it. You know, you don't usually, when you say something like that, think that they mean that those words are meant, but they were. So it's in reality, I probably can feel quite safe, ultimately. But it's always there in the back of my mind. You know, will he want to finish the job?
Well, look, I hope you're successful. I know Justice Minister Helen McEntee has already done some wonderful work, and she's only in the job a wet day, so to speak.
And I will be getting an opportunity to meet up with her.
Yeah, I hope you do. Look, I mean, and obviously the more publicity you get for it, and I know you're doing a few interviews at the moment, and it's been in the papers and stuff like that, so I'm pretty sure at this stage she's well aware of the fact that you're reaching out. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, I hope he gets here.
Thank you so much.
And listen, our thoughts are with you and with your beautiful children, Owen and Rory, as well, and we're all thinking of them tonight now after listening to you. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you.
There you go, Kathleen Chadha. What a shocking, shocking story. You all remember it. Way back in 2013. It seems like such a long time ago now. And I remember the story when it happened. We never stopped talking about it all day, that day in the office, and for days afterwards as well. It was one of the big stories of the time. But to us, it was just a story. And to everybody listening, it was just a story at the time. But there is somebody at the end of that story. And certainly that woman has lost her two children. And not only that, as she mentioned as well, she's lost her family. She did have a husband who she thought loved her, but unfortunately, clearly didn't. Not to the extent that she believed, anyway, when he could do such a horrendous, depraved thing like that.
Real people, real opinions, real talk radio. The multi-award-winning Niall Boylan Show. Classic Hits.